Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Jonathan Briggs, the author of Sounds French, Globalization, Cultural Communities, and Pop Music, 1958 to 1980. And the book was published by Oxford University Press in 2015. Hi there, Jonathan.
Hi, Roxane. Big fan of the show. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Could you begin by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Well, sure. Like a lot of the scholars that have been part of this podcast, a lot of it began when I was very, very young and early interactions with French language and French culture. I made a kind of momentous decision at a very young age to take French, and it introduced me to this world of French culture and the French people. And so it really started from there. And I'd always been very fascinated by the similarities and differences between American culture and French culture. So it's been something that's been a fascination of mine since I was a teenager in some ways. And once I began to study history, I still remain fascinated with French history. So this became a way of kind of uniting those two ideas. Being a French historian, I could marry my fascination with French culture with studying the past, and there you have it.
And music?
Sure. I grew up as a both a listener and avid listener of music, and then at some point, like many music listeners, I became interested in making my own music and tried that route for a little while. Gigged in bands, things like that, for a number of years. Became very interested in recording, and I really wanted to develop that side, but it didn't really pan out, and the music bubble kind of burst eventually at the end of the 20th century, which sounds so momentous to say. But when I got to grad school, I was still a playing and practicing musician, so it was still something that was very passionate for me.
So I guess I want to start off, Jonathan, by asking some questions that are kind of grounded in the title of the book, right? So the book is called Sounds French. But it's also a book about the relationship between French music, Frenchness, and a broader global context. So I wonder if we could start there with the Frenchness of the book and what you're trying to get at here in terms of the relationship between France and a wider world.
Sure. I think a lot of it, Roxane, really stems from reactions that I would get once I'd finally decided on this topic to be my dissertation topic. And it was very much an uphill battle, especially among fellow scholars of France who really felt that French popular music was lesser, was a kind of ersatz version of American popular music. And I was fascinated by that reaction and kind of puzzled by it, as these were often people who embraced all these other elements of French culture, of French history. And yet, when it came to something like Johnny Holiday, he was also often seen as like a joke. And knowing how passionate French people were about Johnny Holiday and how prolific he was and you know, how successful he had been, I was kind of dumbstruck by that and thought, there's really something here that speaks to Frenchness, but it also speaks to reactions to Frenchness from outside, in this case, American reactions to Frenchness. That Frenchness can only be this kind of one thing, maybe an intellectual or an artistic thing, but it couldn't be, say, rock and roll. French and rock and roll just don't go. And I was fascinated as to why would that be? Why not? Some of the great rock and rollers I know are French. So I was kind of fascinated by the power of this kind of stereotype among, you know, intellectuals, not just people who I was trying to convince of the importance of my topic, but, you know, just kind of general listeners. So that's really where it got started. And it all kind of crystallized for me, oddly enough, during my dissertation defense, when I played some of this music and the initial reaction was laughter. So the idea was this was humorous. So I was, again, very puzzled. This was a music that was made by people who were very passionate about this, and they felt it had great meaning to them. And yet to foreign listeners, more rooted in quote unquote American popular music and its authenticity, they saw this as kind of humorous. So that to me really struck me as, okay, what is it that makes it French and also makes it odd to people who know about this stuff.
So, Jonathan, the book is bookended by 1958, so the beginning of the Fifth Republic, and 1980. So I want to ask you about that periodization here.
Sure.
And what you're getting at here, why does the book start when it does and not in 1945, let's say, and why does it end in 1980?
Right. Well, 1958, certainly a pivotal year politically in France. But what I would say is that culturally speaking, it really is the beginning of the rock and roll era in France. We get the appearance of a couple of very important recordings that mark the beginning of this new era of pop music. And so it really does signal a change in kind of French popular culture in terms of music from, say, like the jazz period of the 1950s, which I see more as a product of continuity of earlier aspects of French popular music, things that have been studied by people like Julian Jackson mm-hmm. and Edelbeck. So to me, the 50s have a lot of continuity where this moment in 1958 really is this kind of break, because it's a very definitive type of audience. And that audience is young. That audience is potentially affluent. And that audience is urban. And so I see 1958 as an important marker for that, the development of this culture that would come to be called what I call the culture of the Copains. And then in terms of 1980, again, this is an important end to what we might call the early Fifth Republic, and which after 1980, with the victory of the socialists in 1981, we see a French state that is much more invested in popular culture, in particular popular music. And so to me, again, it kind of transforms that meaning, where in this early period of the Fifth Republic, popular culture is kind of left alone to have its own meanings and its own merits debated by both its producers and its listeners, where the state increasingly after 1980 becomes involved in this, to the point where the state becomes a major subsidizer of culture. This has been talked about in the case of, say, like rap music. Or, I was thinking of the interview on Le Hip Hop that talked. Right. So to me, the intervention of the state really does kind of change the story. And of course, the story of rap is a story that's been told many times already. And so I felt like, well, okay, that story has been told. But what is it that rap was reacting to? What was the popular music that alienated those, the beurs of the banlieue? Like what was it that, was, I guess, the mainstream pop music of the time? And of course, the reactions to that is, I'm just as fascinated in that too.
The other thing that's really central to the title of the book and to the project here is this notion of cultural communities. So I'd like to just, before we get into the stuff of, I mean, I have so many questions I want to ask you about the fantastic stories and figures that you talk about and the music that you talk about in the book, but just sort of setting up the framework here in your approach, what can you tell us about that notion of cultural community and cultural communities? Who are you drawing on to help you think through that? What role does that play in the book?
Sure. Well, I mean, it seems like the kind of standard notion of a cultural community is always built upon, say, the work of the Birmingham School scholars of the 1970s in Great Britain, notions of subcultures and things like this. But again, I find those ideas to be, one, a bit dated at this point. Mm-hmm. But two, it doesn't quite get to the kind of essence of communities, which is that they are these changing things. Communities, they change all the time. We were talking just before the interview here about a building right near you being torn down, right? So, I mean, we think about it, like communities are always changing around us. Sure. And yet we often get trapped, especially as scholars, into thinking about identities as something that we can kind of isolate and find and kind of freeze for a moment. And I think that was what I was trying to get out of, to kind of look at something that was a little more fluid. And so that's where music really helped me, because I feel like music audiences are very, very fluid. You know, there'll be artists who have a lot of followers, and then they might make a quote unquote terrible record, and then they'll have half the followers, right? Well, what has happened here beyond just the idea of an artist making a terrible record? Is there something else to it? Have the tastes of individuals changed, so on and so forth? So I'm interested in this idea of community as this very ephemeral idea. And so again, I'm trying to get to this this notion of globalization as also this introduction to this ephemerality, where we, especially in the Western world, can experience so much at once, and we can experience and consume culture in so many different ways that we connect ourselves to so many different kinds of communities at once. And what does that mean? How do we share ideas? How do we share values? How do we speak as a community? Are we followers? Are we agents in this? You know, so that's where I was really interested in looking at this. And more recently, a lot of, I guess, sociologists of music have been interested in looking at what they would call scenes, you know. So there's, you know, scenes, music scenes, I guess we would call them, right? So there's scenes like here in my home, Chicago. There's scenes in Vancouver. There are famous scenes like the Liverpool scene of the 1960s, the Beats, where, sure, you know, you had the Beatles and things like this. So what is the value of looking at artists within communities, and what does that tell us? And so I was trying to follow up on ideas such as those, but then apply them in a much broader context in this kind of course, the imagination of 60s France, which was all the rage. That's what the debate was really about in the 1960s, this notion of Frenchness. So what happens when these other communities attempt to not just operate within it, but to try to escape it and connect to different kinds of communities? What kind of tensions develop in society? How successful is this? And how do they change?
So it's the nature of this process, Jonathan, of recording an interview that, you know, we're talking about a book and we're talking about a book about music. And, you know, I was thinking about the fact that when I was reading the book, my experience of thinking through these ideas with you as an author was so different, because I stopped every few pages or whatever to listen to some of the music that you were talking about. And I was able to do that because of the companion website that provides a kind of soundtrack to the book. And so I want to ask you about that, just the sort of logistics of that and the decision to do that. But it also makes me want to ask you about, yeah, that challenge as an author of writing about music. How do you talk about music? And what is the relationship in the book between really engaging the music itself, whatever that means, and the way that people talk about music during the period that you're looking at?
Sure. I mean, there's so much to talk about there. Of course, the famous quote we can always go back to is, it's been attributed to so many people that it's kind of been lost, but the idea is writing about music is like dancing about architecture, which I think dancing about architecture sounds amazing and should be done. You know, maybe someone could go out and dance to this wrecked building. But, no, I mean, I'm kind of perplexed at times where people, I mean, there's so many fantastic music scholars that I know who are far better writers than I am that write about music that you would think, well, what is really happening here? But I often think about that with, say, art historians who write about painting, somebody like a T.J. Clark. How can they look at this picture that has no words and come up with all these words? Well, there are ideas there. You know, it's a text in a way, too. Mm-hmm. But of course, most music scholars, especially with pop music, have focused on words. And you know, there's something to that, but I am more fascinated by the noise part, where what is this sound that is making, and why is this sound, which could just be, say, like a C major chord. What makes this sound French in this context, where you put it in another context, it would be Canadian or American or Mexican, or it's the sound is this, the tone is the same. What is it that becomes different? So I really wanted to focus on tone and sound and try to figure out a way of historians engaging with those ideas the same way, you know, we engage with art, the same way we engage with architecture. I think we're trying to engage with things like dance now. You know, we see that there is a text in all of these things, and there is, just like anything else, power and discourse and all these things embedded in these as well. So I feel like the idea of turning to music isn't that radical or revolutionary, but apparently among historians, it kind of is. So, mm-hmm. So for me, it also allowed me to use my knowledge of sound as a musician as well, to say, okay, well, I know how these kinds of things are made. I understand how songs are written. I understand melody and I understand tone. And so what goes behind these decisions and who is making these decisions and why? And what does it tell us about their values and their ideas, both musicians and listeners, in these particular time periods of French history where there are crises going on. Of course, there's always the crisis of French identity, which I guess will always give us a cottage industry as French historians. But the idea is that there is a deliberate decision in sound. And what is that? What are the thought processes behind those decisions? So to me, I really wanted to move away from talking about words and instead talk about sounds.
And then the decision to create this companion website, is that something that's been done before? I've never read a book this way, so I want to ask you about that.
Certainly, you know, not to shill too much for my press, but Oxford has been trying to find more innovative ways of doing music scholarship, and this seemed to be one. I mean, you know, I would like to think that maybe 10 years from now, my book could come out in some kind of, you know, interactive form where mm-hmm. you wouldn't even have to leave the book. You could just go straight kind of into the book, so to speak, and hear the sounds, perhaps even as you read. You know, we're all distracted readers at times anyway. But yeah, I think it is actually quite important to hear these things. As a good narrator as I hope I am, there's no way that I can actually give the entire narration of say a song, because there is something about a sound that is a very visceral experience. So, and plus it also allows, you know, readers to come up with their own interpretations. You know, maybe they would hear something in it and say, oh, well, it reminds me of this or that or the other. You know, I think that to me is the great value of providing essentially these documents that I've looked at to say, okay, well, this is what I think. What do you think? And it gives readers a little bit more agency and kind of getting to it. You know, I mean, we've all read so many scholarly works and, you know, where obviously there's been a lot of archival research done and, you know, archives are great, but, the idea of having that access, you know, we don't always provide documents. We edit out of documents, you know, and even these, I didn't do every single song that I listened to. I don't think I could legally do that, but, but you know, I tried my best to like, okay, these are the ones I deem as important. And, you know, here, what do you think, you know? And what I often find fascinating is that, fans will tell me, cause of course fans know way more about this than I do. I'm merely a scholar, but fans will tell me, oh, well, this is actually the more important song, or, you know, why didn't you talk about this song? You know, so I'm really fascinated in that, because that to me tells me, okay, well, there's even more stories out there that are to be told.
So I want to ask you about pop music, this and the question of genre, right? So how you decided, well, to use that term, but also how do you make decisions about what counts as pop music? Does pop music just mean music with commercial success? I mean, there are moments in the book where that's not exactly what you mean by it. So
exactly.
How are you defining or interrogating that notion of pop music?
Well, this is one of the wonderful things about the French, is that they're going to write a philosophical book on everything. And certainly they've written a number of philosophical works on pop music as well. And so what I've tried to do in this case is to take the French definition at heart and say, okay, well, the French are defining it as essentially what we might call kind of non-art music, although that's not really the case either. It's just a different kind of art, I suppose. But the idea is it's music written for a marketplace. And of course, marketplace is just another way of saying a community, right? It too is another form of community. So these are songs written with a community in mind. Maybe that community is millions of listeners. Maybe that community is 10 listeners. In the case of some of these things I talk about, I would be surprised if more than 10 people, including myself, maybe have heard them. But they are written for listeners. And I think that makes the distinction with pop music from, say, art music, which is kind of written for the sake of itself. And of course, listeners are important to it. But someone like Pierre Boulez is not really interested in how many people are going to hear his work. It's much more about kind of the mysticism of art itself, where Johnny Holiday wants the experience of having the Stade de France full of people singing along with him. Both are very French in their own weird ways. So to me, I tried to take the French notion, how they define pop music, and embrace that. And of course, it's very different from, say, Anglophone versions, which pop music is often has this very derisive, commercial music, as if that's a negative thing. This notion of inauthentic, which comes from this divide between pop music and what we might call rock music, which is more artful, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. The French don't really see those same divides in the same way. It's coming out of a very different tradition. And to me, I'm very fascinated by that. Like, having grown up in one kind of cultural milieu, to discover, oh, wait, there's a whole nother way of thinking about pop music, where it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the thing that you listen to in certain contexts. You know, you don't go to the concert hall and listen to Johnny Holiday. You might listen to jazz music, you know, when you listen to this here. So I wanted to embrace that idea of pop music as this very inclusive thing. And then at the same time, to move to genres, again, I tried to take listeners themselves and artists to some degree, mm-hmm. and take their words to say, okay, this is where they say they belong. Why do they belong to this group of listeners? Or why is this music reflective of this kind of identity according to these artists? So genre is one of those things that is incredibly slippery, but, you know, so is class. So is gender. So is race, right? These great pillars that we've built up so much history on. We know that these two are very, very malleable forms of identity. And so I found genre to be a very effective way of kind of getting at that, like, again, that kind of elusiveness of identity. And I'm sure as a kind of music listener, I guess a professional music listener in some ways, I've always been asked, you know, hey, what kind of music do you like to listen to? And you know, the kind of standard answer is, oh, I listen to all kinds of music, you know, which usually isn't really true. I mean, you have your own preferences, but to you, it seems like you listen to all kinds of music. So I wanted to take the listeners' words themselves. You know, listeners, as you might imagine, they are very, very passionate about music. And, you know, they have their favorite bands, they have their favorite albums, they have their favorite songs, and they like some artists over others. You know, the kind of classic idea of, you know, are you a Beatles fan? Are you a Stones fan? Well, those kinds of debates played out in France numerous times as well. And so it was fascinating. Okay, well, what makes one belong to one group? What makes one belong to another group? And do these groups change? Do they merge together? Do they separate? Do they dissolve? So genre to me was a great way of doing this, because it almost sounds, not to be too punny here, but it sounds like something that seems solid, but is always changing itself.
All right, let's talk about these musicians and these sounds. So the first chapter of the book, Jonathan, begins with, you start off with rock and roll's arrival in France, and you talk about these, the copains and communities of youth. So what can you tell us about the way that rock and roll arrives in France? Who were les copains, and what does all this tell us about youth culture in this period of the late 1950s?
Sure. One of the kind of interesting things to me about the arrival of rock and roll in France is that, France was a very, in the 1950s, there were a lot of kind of musical fads, and it was the same throughout the Western world. You know, you had dances that would be fads, and you might have like a tango fad or a bossa nova fad, things like this. So there was already this kind of fascination with things outside of France that seemed to be pervasive among what we might call the hit parades in France in the 1950s. But the arrival of rock and roll was really shepherded by a jazz musician by the name of Boris Vian, who was a very, very clever man who died very young. It'd be fascinating to kind of see where he was going to go with his art, but he died very young. But he saw rock and roll as kind of silly music in a way. He was more of a jazz fan. And so there was already at this point, this division between the more serious jazz as a form of art and rock and roll as this kind of barbaric form of noise. So the same arguments that were playing out in the United States and in Great Britain and even in places like the Soviet Union, they were also playing out in France as well. So, but Vian never one to miss a buck or a franc, I guess, in this case. He wrote a classic song that made fun of rock and roll called Rock and Roll Mops, which we might think of as a parody of rock and roll. He kind of exaggerated the style, made up some silly lyrics, and, you know, made a good deal of money off it. And It seemed like that, okay, well, that's the end of rock and roll in France. But then as it turned out, this song then led to other similar songs. So again, where, you know, the artist kind of intended one thing, a parody or a mockery, but eventually this song is kind of transformed into something to say, oh, okay, well, we can make this kind of music too. We're French and we can make French songs like this. And so other artists kind of followed up. And of course, there was the commercial aspect of it. So record companies are always looking for ways of making money. This is, of course, true today. And it was true back in the 1950s. And so there was a desire for more of this music, and especially young people making music for young people. And that's, in many ways, what rock and roll kind of became all throughout the Western world, is it became young people making music for other young people. And so that's where the Copains come in. We might think of them in many ways kind of similar to, you know, the baby boom generation all throughout the rest of Europe. And this is a young, affluent group who grew up during the economic miracle in France. Things were actually pretty good for them. And their world was a world of endless possibilities. And so for them, the great possibility was leisure. And, you know, what's more leisurely than a 3-minute rock and roll song for them. And so the Copains were both the audiences, but eventually they also became the artists themselves. And to me, that was one of the kind of fascinating things about this genre that has come to be called Yeah Yeah, which again was meant as a derisive term, but was reappropriated and in fact embraced in many by many young people as like, no, this is our music. You know, this does not belong to the older generation. So as a way of demarcating listeners, but artists were more savvy than that. They wanted as many people listening as possible. So while they often played up this kind of young rebellious image, people like Johnny Holiday would eventually abandon that and try to have a much more broad, almost what we might call professional image, more in line with other types of French singers at the time. So the Copains kind of lived on the precipice of these two worlds, this kind of these old French values, the older French values, and the kind of newer values of the economic miracle, a more open world, a more commercialized world, a faster world in many ways, a noisier world, and a world based on the consumption of leisure, which was an important part of the economic miracle.
You make the point in this chapter where you're discussing the Copains that they ignored racial and gender differences. And I just wanted to ask you to say a little bit more about that connection to a more traditional Frenchness or idea of French community.
Right. And certainly there's not necessarily a follow through with the discourse. So, of course, the idea for the Copans is, you know, we're all friends, men and women, you know, North Africans and white French. So the idea is like it's all inclusive. I mean, that's the notion of the word itself, Copan, you know, pal, mm-hmm. buddy. And we find examples within the Copans of you know, children of immigrants and women. And I think the women, the issue of the Copines is a bigger issue because mm-hmm. the Copines were in many ways just as popular. A Françoise Hardy or a Sylvie Vartan mm-hmm. were equally as popular as a Johnny Holiday or an Eddie Mitchell, where I don't think you see that in the case of, say, the United States, where you don't really have, you have an Elvis Presley, but you don't necessarily have a kind of female equivalent mm-hmm. to that. Same case could be made somewhat in Great Britain, where you have, say, like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, but you have no one that really does kind of match up in the same sense. In France, that does not seem to be the case, where mm-hmm. young women were equally as important. However, one of the things that I kind of left more subtle in this chapter, but is that it's inclusive, but we might also think of it as kind of racially white, meaning that the Copans are for this kind of this inclusive identity, the same way, say, like a, you know, the national project of France might be for an inclusive identity, mm-hmm. so long as it follows these notions of identity, you know, these notions of Frenchness. So it's these notions of Copanazison. So these mm-hmm. notions of this is what it means to be a Copan, you know, where race isn't really talked about. Which you think about it, like what's going on during this period is the end of this very violent war in which a lot of these young people are having to be involved in. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's and in many ways, it's a civil war as well as a war of decolonization. So the rhetoric is nice, but I think in the end, there are some limits to how far that idea can be pushed in terms of say, race. Whereas in terms of gender, I think there's a little bit more equality that I think was maybe a brief moment. I don't know that that's, you know, I'm still thinking about it through in terms of now. And mm-hmm. I don't know that it's kind of maintained that same level. But in that moment in the early 60s, young women were very powerful pop stars in the same way that young men were. And in many ways, I think that's unique to France.
That's really interesting. So, Jonathan, you go on to talk about chanson and, you know, some of these pillars of post-war French music, Brel, Bassin, yes. Ferré, Gainsbourg, also, you know, the actor, the poet, what do you call him? The actor, the poet, the artist, and the iconoclast. And you make the point in this chapter, you're sort of looking at all of these different, I mean, I wish we could spend an hour talking, well, several hours talking about each one of them, but you bring them together to make a point about French chanson as a site of globalization. So could you sort of say a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Sure. And again, this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier about mm-hmm. sound, right? So one of the most, and so much has been done on chanson, and for very good reason. It's a very important genre in French music. It's seen as an elevated form of art by many as kind of a prime example of what it means to what French popular music actually is for many. But I, of course, am interested in what it sounds like. And I think a lot of scholars have focused instead on the beautiful poetic aspect of it, which is fantastic. But, you know, somebody like a Jacques Brel doesn't get up there and talk. He gets up there and he sings. Well, Gainsbourg might get up there and talk, but Jacques Brel, he sang. He, you know, he emoted through music. And so I was really interested in trying to move beyond just the talk of words again and to say, well, what does chanson mean as a sound? And what I found fascinating is that these three men, that Breuil, Brasson, and Ferret, they were essentially put forth as this kind of pillar of this is what real French popular music is. And yet within their own sounds, within their own ideas, you can see that they're kind of open to some of these influences from outside of France. And they are doing their best to kind of integrate what we might call some modern sounds into their music. And so I was really fascinated by how that discussion has really not been talked about. That, you know, there has been this discussion of their words. There's been this discussion of how they themselves in many ways kind of rejected notions of pop music. But in some cases, especially in the case of somebody like Gainsbourg, but even Ferret, they were open to many of these ideas as artists and explorers of different sounds. Mm-hmm. So to me, I think that's why I wanted to say, you know, okay, well, we tend to think of chanson as this idea. And of course the French themselves, there's an entire just whole cases of books in the BNF. Trust me, I've looked at them. about chanson, where the French have written a lot about it. And I was just fascinated by kind of this rehearsal of myth about it, that, mm-hmm. you know, it's like this old, almost unchanging form. And certainly that could be made the case if we're just looking at words, but that's not what chanson is. And so I'm fascinated by the change in sound. And of course, the fact that it's happening in the 60s, to me, is not a coincidence, but a time of great social and cultural change in France, the 1960s. So this very central notion of French culture, on the one hand, is being presented by artists and by music critics as this kind of unchanging form. Mm-hmm. And yet, on the other hand, it very much is changing if you pay attention to the sound.
You go on in the book, Jonathan, to talk about 1968 as a kind of watershed moment in pop music and to talk about the progressive rock. And I guess I want to ask you what that term means exactly after 1968. So what are you getting at here in terms of the relationship between music and politics and the role that 68 plays in the story that you're telling here?
Well, in many ways, the events of 68 serve as kind of a parenthetical period. It's a very non-musical period in many ways. There are some important musical movements, you know, in the Sorbonne. There are a few musical organizations that join in the general strike. But for the most part, music didn't play the same kind of unifying role that it did, say, in the American Civil Rights Movement or the protest movement in Berkeley. Or in Chicago in 1968, it played less of a role. And so what I see, though, is that after 68, a lot of musicians, especially on the political left, realize that there was kind of a missed opportunity. And so they seek to find a way of marrying these kind of seemingly incompatible ideas, you know, pop music, which is, you know, this consumerist market-driven music and very radical leftist ideas seeking to overturn French society. For the most part, they don't really mesh them together very well. But I'm fascinated by the idea of these kind of long hairs down in their laboratories trying to fuse these two atoms that just can't mix together, and the frisson that they get, because to me it's quite amazing, this music. And the term progressive rock is actually a British term. Mm. And it came to mean this kind of this art music, this merger between rock music and art music. So like this is like the period where you'd have bands playing like Pachelbel's Canon, or they would be doing like Rimsky-Korsakov, but with rock instrumentation. So this kind of almost like facile way of thinking about these two things. But mm-hmm. in the French case, I think they took a much more, a much richer approach to it, because I think they were very, very serious about their politics. Because again, I think this is the case for young people. This is a place where they saw, okay, well, the political revolution failed. Perhaps this cultural revolution that we're seeking could come through pop music. Of course, that would mean that lots of people would have to listen to this, and nobody really listened to this. This is very fringy music.
Right.
So I'm fascinated. Like, how do you create a popular revolution with music nobody wants to listen to? But they were trying to work out this conundrum, and I think in the end, these bands who were very, very passionate about their politics eventually kind of abandoned the political aspect and kind of went for the art for art's sake aspect of this particular genre. So they, in many ways, they kind of followed the paths of progressive rock music elsewhere in the world. But for this kind of strange period of about 5 years, the French were trying something that lots of other places weren't really trying. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with the power of 68 as this symbol, maybe a failed revolution, or, you know, we just needed to go a little bit further. And I mean, you can see this with, you know, the formation of Trotskyite parties and mm-hmm. House parties. So, and in fact, in this chapter, I talk about how some of these bands tried to, you know, run themselves along very much these ideas. And it didn't make them very popular, but it makes for some kind of fascinating insight into this period.
Yeah, it sort of makes me want to ask you, Jonathan, that, you know, they don't want to listen to this. People don't want to listen to this music, but of course people are maybe not always, but they are often listening to music. And so I'm just wondering about how you negotiate in the book this interest in globalization for yourself, you know, an interest in music that is produced, well, by French or these Francophone artists, not exclusively, but predominantly for a French and Francophone audience, with the fact that people are listening to music from all over the place, and especially from the United States and Britain and that sort of thing. So is it that the folks who are most committed to that politics are listening to music from elsewhere that may or may not be committed to that politics? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. And I think that is the case. I think that one of the things about this particular music, and what's also interesting about that, is I don't think it's necessarily just this kind of underground music. I think that the larger framework, the kind of commercial popular artists are also looking elsewhere. Mm-hmm. It's just where they're looking. So a lot of say, like, these artists are looking to, you know, the experiments of electronic musicians who are interested in looking at sound as a form of art that can be democratized, and that all sounds should have a value. And they're really kind of embracing a more democratic idea of art. You know, these are kind of people who are working in musique concrète at the time. But also looking, one of the big things happening is that there are these radical transformations in American jazz at the time. We get the development of free jazz, mm-hmm. Which is very, very upfront about its politics, which it has to be, because the sound itself is so aggressive, but it is just sound. So it's often accompanied by, you know, manifestos. The sound is about you know, discrimination in the United States. And so French listeners really embrace those ideas. And in fact, a lot of free jazz artists from the United States were more popular in France. They actually had longer careers playing to audiences in France. And so there is this kind of global, again, this global embrace of these forms. So can the form of free jazz be integrated into French popular music to transform the consciousness, if you will, of the listener? Well, it wouldn't appear so, but there were attempts to do it. And so I'm fascinated by those attempts. Or, you know, should there be these demarcations between high art and low art? Well, you know, progressive rock musicians didn't think so. They thought there should just be kind of one art for all. Did that really work out? Not really. But again, it does speak to these kind of revolutionary interests and how a number of artists during the early 1970s were trying to make pop music not just popular, so to speak, but also revolutionary mm-hmm. along these ideas of 68.
You point out, as you move into the discussion of regionalism and folk culture in Brittany in the 1970s, that most of the book is focused around Paris. So I wanted to ask you about that, thinking about the urbanization and the urban centers with respect to the project here, but also that moment where you go in the book where you focus on Brittany and this idea of the folk. What's the relationship of that piece of it to the larger argument that you're making in the book?
Sure. Well, and one other thing that's important to think about is that, Paris was certainly a commercial center, you know, all the major recording studios, all the major record labels, mm-hmm. the major theaters, they were all located in Paris. If you were going to be a popular musician, you kind of had to, you know, if you could make it there, you could make it anywhere, so to speak, right? It's kind of funny how some of these things just kind of happen that way. But it does seem to create this, in some ways, a very insular idea of Frenchness. So I really wanted to find a counterexample. And regionalism was such a powerful and passionate issue in the 1970s that it seems like, okay, and regionalists, especially regional musicians, weren't as interested in working within the same frameworks that popular musicians were interested in. They were interested in promoting their particular values. And of course, their values spoke to a different community, this community of the region, mm-hmm. Whatever that is. So I wanted to focus on that. And Brittany just seemed like such a powerful example because the musicians from there, in fact, were very successful, not just in among French listeners, but among European listeners. Mm-hmm. I mean, people like Alain Cybelle and Trion, they had an international fan base. And I thought, okay, well, they're speaking to these ideas that are very, very specific and very, very particular to, you know, to islands, to dialect, to, you know, these very mythical ideas of this tiny place in France. Mm-hmm. And yet the audiences are quite large. Like how does that happen? And what does that mean, of course, that these ideas are moving across borders, especially within the debates about regionalization? What is the relationship between the region and the nation in France? An issue I still don't think that has been resolved. And I think that is still an ongoing issue in France. As someone who lived in Brittany for a while doing research, it's very, very, very different than being at the BNF or being, you know, in the Île-de-France. It's a very different notion of even music itself.
So the other part of the 70s that you look at is you come back to Paris to talk about punk.
Yes.
And you talk about punk in Paris in the 70s and look at it in terms of the limits of globalization and make the argument essentially that the punk failed. So I wanted to ask you to say more about that.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I found very fascinating about French punk is, in many ways, this is where the entire project started, is that I read a number of books about punk itself. And of course, punk is often seen as either an American phenomenon or more often a British phenomenon.
Right.
And there is very little written about the French context. And what I did find, in fact, it turned out to be actually wrong, which I was fascinated by, you know, but in the same sense, it'd be like, well, who would care? And then I realized, well, I care. So I wanted to find out what was happening. And as it turns out, the French were very, very open to punk. And in many ways, I was like, well, of course, you know, punk is all about, you know, tearing down cliches. And it's all about, you know, reinventing yourself and, you know, that you could be somebody different and you didn't have to have musical talent. You didn't have to be trained. And so I thought, well, if French music is looked at as this kind of ersatz thing, you know, well, punk is all about like the celebration of the ersatz. So punk should be really big in France. And in fact, in many ways it was, there was an absolute overflowing of bands. And I wish I mean, I wish I could have been there, because I know with punk, there were so many more that didn't record, but there were so many that did record. Mm-hmm. And they all were participating in this culture that, you know, they saw themselves as part of, but that in many ways, the punks in Paris believed they were part of an axis. You know, there was New York, and then there was London, and then there was Paris. And it was like this axis, the axis of punk, you know, I guess mm-hmm. it sounds kind of sinister, but the idea was that, you know, they belonged to, again, this cosmopolitan community. So I wanted to understand, well, how is it that the French in many ways could understand punk culture, and yet in many ways it didn't work out for them? Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of where it gets back to this notion of communities. Well, you can say you belong to community as much as you want, but it's a dialectical thing. I mean, others in the community have to agree with your what we might call citizenship in the community. And if that's rejected, then you don't belong to that community. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's why I wanted to talk about kind of this limits of globalization, that, you know, we can talk about how there are all these opportunities that global culture creates. And yet at the same time, it also creates these divides, because there are people who play country and Western music in, you know, Azerbaijan. Are they seen as belonging to the Nashville sound? Probably not. Hmm. Right. And I'm kind of fascinated by, well, why not? And what is it that's happening? And so to me, I thought punk would be this kind of great moment where all of these divisions were going to kind of fall. And in fact, what ended up happening is the punks themselves in France had this rigorous, deep intellectual debate, only in France, right, about what it meant to be punk. And in the end, they were divided, because many said, well, you can't be punk and be French, because it's all about being British or being American, which I found very fascinating, that people who understood punk would still kind of keep these boundaries on it. And then there were others who said, no, we're just as punk as anybody else. And I mean, aesthetically speaking, I think that the bands there were aesthetically punk as anywhere else, but they've been kind of written out of the histories of punk. So part of me, I was insisted on and in getting that in, not just because it talked about that, but it kind of forces us to rethink about punk as something more cosmopolitan, rather than, you know, these long rehearsed stories about the Ramones or the Sex Pistols. You know, it's become a new type of classical music. You know, there's Beethoven, there's Bach, and there's Mozart. You know, in punk, there's the Clash, the Sex Pistols, and the Ramones. You know, but there's more to the story, obviously. And I think especially in the age of globalization, where these ideas can move, at that moment in the late 70s, the needle didn't move, so to speak, in France, which was right there, and it was happening right there, and yet it didn't happen.
So, Jonathan, the book it runs from 1958 to 1980, but in the coda to the book, you do reach into the 80s and 90s, touching on electronic music. Well, first rap in the 80s, which isn't to say that it ends at the end of the 80s, but you talk about rap in the 80s, and then you move into talking about electronic music. So I guess I want to ask you how you see the period after the 80s continuing with some of the issues and themes that you're exploring in the book, in the kind of chronology of the book, and what some of the breaks might be. I mean, you began with the discussion of what that shift to socialist government means,
right,
in the early 80s. In terms of the music, what is the break there, and what do the 80s and 90s, where do they take us?
Well, I think one of the kind of compelling things, I mean, what happened with punk, the kind of opposite happens with rap, in that French rap, as they call it, is embraced, and not just by say, like, you know, the Ministry of Culture and audiences, but it is seen as a kind of viable form of French culture in a way that, say, French punk isn't. It's something that, you know, is studied today in, you know, French language classes, where I doubt that they're sitting and listening to Metal Urban, although they should. But, you know, the idea is, like, it is seen as French, even though it's rap, and even though, of course, it's rooted in the culture of the banlieue. So I'm kind of fascinated by that difference. And to me, of course, in many ways, it strikes me kind of similar to the story of Chanson, where, okay, this is why it fits in, because, of course, rap is all about language and wordplay, mm-hmm. and the importance of like artistic identity and like the voice of the speaker, where, you know, not a lot of music is about that, but that actually seems to fit in with a lot of what French listeners might be preconditioned to be looking for. On the other hand, French electronic music has been incredibly successful worldwide and was, in fact, French electronic artists were important tastemakers for global pop music in the late 90s and the early 2000s. So what I find fascinating is that there was almost this, it's almost like a story of struggle where, you know, you have your Johnny Holidays and you have your Red Noises and all these artists that are forgotten by anybody except the French. And then you have these success stories, you know, like an MC Solar or nowadays somebody like a Stromae, or you have a Daft Punk who can go and win, awards in America.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a sense, like there has now been success where before there was struggle. So in a sense, that's a very different story. But I think what has happened now is that French music has found a more international audience. And you see a lot more French artists having success, not just in other countries in Europe, but, you know, having success in the United States. So it's a kind of a different story now. And I think that now with the internet age and with greater awareness about what's going on in different countries, you can see a lot more crossover. And I think that's the case here. That's what's happening with French pop music today. And also, I'm very excited because I'm going to get to see Stromae in a couple of months.
Oh, I was just going to ask you that.
He's coming. Of course, he's coming to Chicago. So I'm going to go and see him. And I'm very excited. And
yeah.
And of course, and then you have things like, so a Chicago tradition here, which is the Pitchfork Festival. It now has, there's a Pitchfork Festival in Paris. So Paris has its own group of hipsters. And so there is this kind of all of this kind of cross-pollination that seems to be going on now, that in many ways, when I was looking back at this period in the 70s, that germination didn't really happen. Hmm. So it seems like that maybe finally with greater access to culture and information through file sharing, through blogs and things like that, like that there is a greater kind of audience for French pop music.
Well, Jonathan, there's about a million other things I want to talk to you about, but I'm just going to ask you one more question, which is, what are you working on now?
Oh, well, so I've been working on French pop music for about 12 years of my life, and I feel like I cannot say another thing about it, or at least write another thing about it. I still don't mind talking about it. But so with my next project, I've begun working on an analysis of the politics of the treatment of autism in France, which I see as part of a different kind of globalization, which is the globalization of medicine and the ideas of normality and the ideas of kind of medical practices and how they affect other communities elsewhere. So, of course, France treats autism in radically different ways than Anglophone countries, but that is changing due to a lot of pressure from things like the World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested in where and the kind of origins of that, you know.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And I'd like to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
I'd like to keep talking to you about music off air, but talk to you about that book when it's out in new book form. Jonathan, I just want to thank you so much for writing this fascinating book and for joining me and talking with me about it today.
Well, thank you so much, Roxanne. I really appreciate the time as well and all the great questions.